Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and Double West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 316 of Registry Matters. Larry, it seems that you were being attacked by things last week.
Yes, I was on my deathbed.
Are you doing better now?
Yes, I got off of the deathbed.
Okay. Was there anybody waiting for you? Was there like a big black shadow figure with a big sword thing coming at you?
All the stuff you hear—that's what I saw. I saw the fire.
You saw the light at the tunnel.
I saw the bright lights and the flames, and I saw.
You saw flames?
Oh no! Oh no! No, that's the wrong vision, Larry. You don't want to go that way.
I saw all that stuff, and I asked for one more chance, and I got another opportunity to be here. But I got some insect bites, and they were not kind to me. The poison was very difficult on me for a couple of days.
All right. Do you know what it was?
Not been able to determine that. I'm assuming it was some type of spider.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, hey, Chance, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing very, very well. Thank you.
Still 80 degrees and sunny and 10% humidity?
No, not even close. Kind of readjusted down to just, 75 sunny, slightly windy, little puffy clouds, that kind of thing.
Oh my gosh. Okay. That sounds also kind of amazing.
Oh man.
All right. So Larry, tell me what we're doing tonight while I actually fire up another piece of equipment that I forgot to launch.
We're all over the map this week. We have a letter that's going to be read from one of our listeners, a podcast subscriber, transcript subscriber, now out in the free world. And we have another clip from the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia sharing some of his wisdom. And we have some emails that I plan to read that are a bit strange, but I have a purpose for reading them, and it will become clear once we get into it, but we got some criticism that we're going to cherry pick some emails and read. And I've selected...
You don't need me to turn them off on our end, do you?
We might have to do that, yes. I've selected one article of interest, if we can get to it, because it comes from that liberal bunch of whack jobs on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And Chance is with us, so we have a California corner, and this segment unpacks a recent case dealing with removal from the registry. And my understanding that is it might be a little bit of a slight setback, but we'll get into that more.
And are we going to then hop on over to listen to Mr. Scalia?
Indeed. We're going to listen to him talk about how the Constitution doesn't change and words never change meanings.
I still can't. I mean, like, I understand the words. I just can't really get on board with what he's saying. All right. And this button.
What a weird notion that a document changes its meaning from decade to decade, and it's going to be up to the judges to decide what it means, especially when this document makes an exception to democratic self-governance. When this document says, no, even if the people want to do certain things, they can't do it. I think it's a very strange notion that what those things are is going to be decided from time to time by unelected judges. It seems to me the normal way anybody reads a text is, what does it mean? And if it's an old text, what did it mean? What did it mean when it was written or when it was adopted? Which is why you have glossaries, for Pete's sake.
Okay.
And your thoughts there, Larry?
I want people to know when we say things that sometimes we're quoting the conservative icon, and new listeners often don't realize the context of that. But when I say that textualism means that the words always meant what they meant 50, 100, 200 or more years ago, this is the conservative icon saying that. And we'll have more from Scalia in future episodes, but this is his interpretation philosophy. Words mean what they meant at the time, not what you think they should mean today.
Chance brought up the word, maybe it was you or Chance brought up the word browser last go around.
It was me. I asked people if you said looking for browsers in 1974, what would a person have thought you meant versus if you say looking for browsers in 2024?
And I'm just, if we could hypothetically say that a law was written with the word browser, fag, or what's the other word that I want to use? Or gay. If somehow those words were used in the text in the 1900s or something like that, and you would read it today, these words have vastly different meanings. So now you have the word browser, and you guys were saying that maybe it's like someone that's going around a store browsing.
That is correct.
You would have to be balancing all kinds of different terms on how you read something then and now, and it seems really complicated on how you would do that.
Not according to Scalia. He says you give the words the meaning as they were understood at the time. Cruel and unusual punishment.
He said there's a glossary.
Cruel and unusual punishment. What did it mean at the time when they were drafting the Constitution, when they said no cruel and unusual punishment? He doesn't think you should look at how we've evolved to view punishment. Now he believes that you would look at what it was understood to have meant at the time. Not today.
Yeah, go into the tar pit, go into the tar pit and retrieve the dinosaur and examine it. Correct.
And you mean what by that?
Well, I mean that if snuff meant cocaine in the 1700s, what does cocaine mean today?
What does snuff mean today?
Well, you know, I think you kind of get it. Yeah.
So. But yes, this type of interpretive philosophy has its good and it has its bad. I wish our people would understand that textualism can be beautiful when it wins your case. But it's not the cure-all, end-all. It's disadvantageous most of the time for us. Yeah, we've covered cases like the Nebraska guy that was in Colorado and moved to Nebraska, and he argued he shouldn't have to register. And they said, well, you are a person, aren't you? You did move here from Colorado, did you not? You had to register in Colorado, did you not? But yeah, you guys don't register juveniles in Nebraska. They said, well, but you are a person, right? That's what the law says. And he says, but you ought to look at the intent of the law. And he said, no, the court said, we don't look at the intent. It says this, and it meant that. If they had wanted to make exceptions for out-of-state juvenile adjudications, they would have done that. That's the Scalia doctrine.
All right, then. A friend of mine sent this email, and he sent a voicemail, and his name is No Soy Nadie. Do you know what that means, Larry?
I have no idea.
That's what his name is. But he's a good friend of mine. He's up in the northeast part of Georgia, and he sent in this voicemail.
Good afternoon, Registry Matters. This is Chris. I'm calling about an I-131F, which is a parole in place for non-citizens married to a U.S. citizen. My wife last week, who is a non-citizen, went and spoke to an attorney who stated that the AWA would have no effect on her application. This is in direct contrast to everything that I have ever heard about sponsoring someone for citizenship in the United States. Her son, who has just turned 21, I believe would be a better option. However, speaking with the attorney last week, they said that they would only look at her charges, not at mine. I'm highly skeptical of this. As you well know, anybody with someone, a person forced to register, would not be able to sponsor someone for citizenship. Any help that you could have on shedding some insight on this would be greatly appreciated. Thank you very much for your time, guys, and FYP.
We need to sign him up to be the announcer on that FYP.
He's a big Borts fan, by the way.
So, this is not my area of expertise, but I agree with his concern. I don't think that that lawyer was giving all the advice that would be appropriate for this situation. But since I'm not an expert, unless Chance is, I think we should make a referral. Chance, do you know anything about this? But I believe that the attorney was giving incomplete advice. I think there is an impact.
Doesn't sound right. You know, I practice criminal law. That's an immigration law question. Probably should refer him.
Well, the best resource I know, who's been at a couple of the NARSOL conferences, is a guy named Alan Lawley. And Alan is really intelligent and passionate about this particular issue. I don't have his contact information easily handy, but you can Google Alan Lawley, L-O-L-L-Y. And you said he was in San Diego, right?
Yeah, he's in San Diego. You'll find him.
And that would be the best advice I would give, is to talk to someone who has extensive knowledge. And actually, Alan has been litigating these claims for people who want to sponsor their spouses. And so he would be a great resource.
He is. Excellent referral.
Well, then, moving along, can I say this person's name?
You can if you'd like, or you could just give him a first name.
I'm just going to give him John, but you put more in the show notes there. All right, so we have a letter handwritten to Registry Matters that says, Larry, Andy, and Chance. I have recently been released to a halfway house after serving 7 years of a 10-year sentence for CP. I have written several times while incarcerated and now actually able to listen to some of your episodes. I have to say, great job. I truly appreciate the no BS, unvarnished truth. That's us right here, man. No BS. It pains me that others here cannot handle some of the unpopular and negative stories that you broadcast because he feels like his mental health and anxiety aspirates. This causes his stress levels to rise, even when talking to family. I don't want you two or three to stop, but for those who seem to be put off by so much negativity, in quotes, is there any ideas of episodes of just positive moments of PFRs or something to help increase listenership? You talked about volunteering. This is probably the section you want to cover, Larry. How would one volunteer? I don't know if my Ohio SOR location has a local office or all is remote or what. I will be moving in 6 months anyways. But while in the Capitol, I'd like to do something, but I'm ignorant for where to start and how to represent my concerns. I feel my vocabulary and public speaking gets me to stumble the point hidden underneath. It seems difficult to get legislators to move the needle when the public seems uninterested in learning the facts. Granted, NPR may do a segment once a year that is semi-positive for a PFR, but it seems like the majority of any news cycle emphasizes disingenuous facts like the high and scary recidivism. As a long plan to move the needle for legislators, shouldn't our group figure out how to move the needle of the general public too? And how would you recommend we do that? Thank you for the diligent information. I wish I'd like to read all of that case law that you seem to do on a daily basis. Any advice on finding these resources and maybe a way to have it read to me while I read it to help me get through some of the dry sections, because sometimes it's difficult for me to see the message telegraphed in some of the opinions. Respectfully, John. There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, I wasn't going to go deep into all of it, but we can take the part that I really focused on was how to get involved. Because I try to give cautionary notes to people who want to be involved, particularly while they're under supervision. You do have constitutional rights where you're under supervision, but you don't have the full, what is that, panoply, the word I'm looking for, Chance? You don't have the full gamut of rights. You forfeit some of your rights, like your right to privacy and to being searched. You know, you have a diminished expectation of privacy. But some of the rights you don't forfeit, like petitioning the government for redress of your grievances, to go to church. There are certain things that you don't forfeit. But when you start getting involved with a PFR advocacy, by its very nature, almost all of those people have been convicted of a crime and most likely a felony. So what the supervising authorities are going to do is they're going to tell you to stay away from felons. And if you hang out with felons, they're going to consider any meeting that you're having to be a voluntary association with known felons. And that may get you in trouble. Which brings me to the point where you're under supervision. You're going to be able to do fewer things, but there's still things you can do. Ohio does have a group. It's very informal, very small, but they do have an RSOL chapter. They don't have an office, but you could connect with Ohio RSOL, because even if you can't meet with them, you can donate $5 or $10. You can do research for them. You can get with their volunteer coordinator, if they have such a thing, and find out what their needs are and what you can do to volunteer to help them. But I discourage going to meetings where there's a bunch of people that might have been convicted of a felony, because that may come back to haunt you. And moving the needle is very difficult, but he has hit the nail. It's the people. That needle will move very quickly when the people move. When the people's opinion change, our country will no longer be the incarceration leader of the world when the American people don't want to incarcerate so many people. Once we convey that as our public policy, as individuals, when you're voting, when you contact your lawmaker and say, you did knock at my door and I'm considered voting for you, but I want to know, are you going to commit to locking up fewer people and looking for alternatives to incarceration? And if they hem-haw, you know that that person shouldn't get your vote. Because they're not going to, if they hem-haw when you ask them a direct question, they're going to get worse after they win the election.
Are you saying that we should be single-issue voters?
Saying we should not be single-issue voters. But I'd say that you should evaluate the importance of each issue as it impacts your life directly. For example, I think very few men have abortions. You know, nobody comes to mind that I can think of in my very long life. So therefore, as a male, an abortion question would be a little bit less down the totem pole if I were making that decision, because I would be thinking about, well, I can't go to my kid's school play. I can't go to the PTA meeting. I can't watch my daughter and cheer. I can't do these kind of things because of these prohibitions. And I'm on lifetime supervision. I can never get off. I would look at the issues that relate directly to my life with a slightly higher elevation above abortion. That's just me. Maybe it's irrational to some others, but I'm not going to let an issue that's never going to impact me. If I don't impact me, if I don't believe in abortion, I just won't have one. And I haven't scheduled one yet and don't plan to. Have you had one yet?
I haven't really signed up for that yet. Chance?
No, I'm not thinking of it right now. No,
but I'm being a little bit tongue in cheek, but I'm telling you, yes, one issue voters are dangerous. But if you're going to be a well-rounded voter, you will prioritize what's more important to you in the overall arching scheme of issues. You should not let one issue dictate. We've got listeners that say that they will never vote for a member of the Democrat Party, and you can explain to them why. Andy, why does that person say he'll never vote for a Democrat?
Because they're trying to destroy this nation?
No, you said I think it was about abortion.
That is a thing.
Yeah, but that person.
Oh, you're talking about that friend? Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Yes, my friend said he will never vote for a Democrat because unless they happen to be pro-life, then he would at least consider them. He's incredibly progressive and liberal on almost every other subject, but that one, he's a Catholic. I think that kind of goes with the territory.
So, well, but yes, there should. One issue voters are dangerous.
Do you think that a person that donates money to NARSOL, affiliates, AXOL, anybody, could there be an issue with a handler in that kind of scenario?
I'm not thinking anything coming to mind. There's always an exception, however. Like in my state, the state probation parole can be very aggressive with monitoring your financial affairs. And they have clauses in the probation conditions that say that significant purchases like vehicles and significant things have to be pre-approved by your probation officer. But giving $10 to an organization, I can't imagine that that would come on the radar screen within a zone of, hey, you can't give to this organization. I've never heard of that. But with our vast audience that reaches into the hundreds of thousands, we may be giving them an idea of something else to put in their probation terms.
And then Axol had a phone call in the last week or two, and Narsol did a Narsol in Action a couple of weeks ago. Can you imagine that puts somebody under some level of threat of participating over a telephone?
It could.
Could you think so?
Well, it depends on what your conditions are. You know, you cannot associate. Okay, and that's a common condition for parole or probation. It's best to always ask permission ahead of time. And usually the answer is, yeah, you can do that, but at least you know ahead of time, you don't have to worry about it.
And then what were the other things that people could do? What about going and talking to your, whichever level of person you want to go see, but your representatives, whether that's Senate or Congress, state or anybody like that? Would you think that that's something that one shouldn't do?
It would be conditional upon, like, for example, if you were in New Mexico and you were in any county other than Santa Fe County, you would need permission to travel to Santa Fe County because you're barred to being able to travel only within your own county of supervision. But you could ask for permission to go to the Capitol. If you could not receive that permission, nothing would stop you from calling or emailing or remotely appearing online at a committee hearing.
Well, maybe. Then again, I mean, you know, some politicians have been convicted of felonies and you cannot associate.
Does anyone come to mind at first blush that would fall in that category?
I wouldn't know about that, but I just think that theoretically, if a politician has been convicted and you're, you know, getting together with them, I think that may violate your conditions.
I like the way you think, Chance. So that would mean that of these 20 and 30,000 people that show up at a rally, if any of them under supervision, that if they were being intellectually honest, that would be a felon association, would it not?
It would. And by the way, if you're a convicted felon, you know and I know that there are certain places you can go and can't go, and, you know, international travel is an issue.
Well, yeah, that's funny. But yeah, I think there's a lot of things that people can do that would not be in a zone of any threat to them. But while you're under supervision, be extremely careful, because I like for Chance to make money, but I hate for you to have to call him and say, what do I do now? They've locked me up.
Yeah, because then I'll say, send money. Send lots of money. Send money now.
Let us know. We'll put money on your books for you.
So, all right.
Correct.
All right, well, we have this long section here, and I want to sort of apologize up front because it's a whole long meandering kind of conversation. But anywho, please dig in, Larry.
Well, I'm asked calling at a point of personal privilege. We got a little bit of criticism for something that was spoken at the national conference in June, and I didn't listen to the segment that was cited, but it was something to the effect that we advise people to do things, and then we don't support them when they follow our advice. And the issue is, in the state of Missouri, in the county of Greene County, Missouri, the sheriff only takes reservations to register by electronic communication. And the issue that this thread goes into detail was about the fact that this person has a mental disability, I believe it is, and he's not allowed by his guardian to be online for various reasons that are not clear to me, but still that's his prerogative as his guardian. And the sheriff of Greene County will not make an exception. And the issue is, this is an accommodation that's being requested pursuant to the Americans with Disability Act, the ADA. So I wrote, after a barrage of emails from over the last couple of weeks, I finally responded to the guy. So I'm going to read my responses, and then Andy will be reading the responses from participant number one, participant number two. And I don't like reading, but I will do my best. It says, I said, please accept my sincere apology for the slow response to your messages. I've been adversely impacted by health issues recently. In fact, I had to cancel last week's podcast due to health problems. We have your emails and documents related to the issues you were having with the Greene County Sheriff's Office. At first glance, it's unlikely that NARSL will be in a position to provide assistance. This is not our final determination because our paralegal has not yet reviewed the documents, and there are other cases ahead of yours awaiting his attention. My estimation is it will be no less than 30 days, or likely longer, before the review is complete. The paralegal will be in touch if he needs additional documentation or has questions. My personal suggestion is that you try to back off the confrontational approach and look for a way to resolve this amicably. If the sheriff is requiring that appointments be made by electronic communications, I'd comply for now to avoid any potential consequences. If this were occurring in my state, our office would advise the person to compose a polite letter to the sheriff's office informing them that they were scheduling their appointment electronically per instructions received from the sheriff's office. It's extremely unlikely that the Greene County Prosecuting Attorney's Office would initiate a prosecution for violation of the Sexual Offender Registration Act when it's the sheriff that instructed the registrants to schedule electronically. Beyond that, the prosecuting attorneys do not generally develop their own cases from scratch. Cases are initiated by law enforcement investigation, and then law enforcement turns their file, which includes all the documentations, over to the prosecutor's office with a recommendation. This means the Greene County Prosecutor's Office would inevitably need a law enforcement officer from the Sheriff's Office to testify. I do not see that happening. I do understand you do not want your ward to be online using electronic devices. That's your decision. I'd encourage you to try very hard to de-escalate this situation before it spirals out of control. Now, we have a 32-year practitioner of law here. Do you see anything hostile, derogatory, demeaning, or inappropriate in that email?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Zero.
Is there anything lack of factual? Do prosecutors develop their own cases?
Say that again?
Is there anything unfactual? Do prosecutors develop their own cases, or do they receive files from law enforcement saying, we'd like to see this case prosecuted? Here's the file.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And the truth is, you know, law enforcement sticks their nose into their business all the time. Shouldn't be theoretically prosecutors do receive information from law enforcement, and then they decide whether or not they're going to do anything about it.
Right. So if the Greene County Sheriff in Missouri tells a sexual offender that I will only schedule you through an electronic communication, unless that person woke up one day and had a divine vision from the good Lord, that was the policy of the Greene County Sheriff's Office. It was announced in some capacity, either a notice on the door or a letter or some way it was communicated to the registrants. Therefore, there's a paper trail of this direction. Okay, his concern is that the person, since they have not disclosed their email addresses, they're not allowed to be online without disclosing them in Missouri law. His contention is that they could be prosecuted. I think that is so far-fetched, because the first thing I'm going to do if I were involved in the defense team is I'm going to say, well, here's a copy of the notice or the sign on the door that says you must schedule by sending us an email or by whatever the means is. I just can't fathom that the prosecuting office in Greene County would say, sucker, we got you now. You did what the sheriff told you, we're going to lock you up.
I don't think so. That's right.
I just don't see that happening. So therefore,
yeah,
I would try to de-escalate this. The hostile emails calling the sheriff names, I don't ever encourage that. I will guarantee you, without listening to a single thing from that Atlanta conference, I did not advise anybody to be hostile, derogatory, name call. That's not who I am. In fact, I do just the opposite. I tell people, don't do name calling. I don't like when I hear that the Democrat Party wants to destroy America. I don't like to hear that the Republican Party wants to cause people to breathe dirty air and that they want to starve granny out by killing Social Security. I don't like that. I do just the opposite. I do not call people losers, liars, and all this kind of stuff. That was the first point of this email. All this stuff, communication with the sheriff, should have been polite and professional. In my opinion, it was not. And I think when you hear some of the more of the exchanges about how it got very personal, you'll see the tip of the iceberg. Okay, Andy, go for it. This is response from Party One.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Should I make like a fake voice?
No, you're
fine. I don't think I can do
you're it. You're fine.
You're fine. Okay. Here's response from party number one. I did exactly what you said to do. I got all of the proof you need for a viable claim and explosive case to litigate, which would make a serious impact in challenging registry issues. So it bears repeating. You claim this is a worthy fight, but where are you on the battlefield? In RM308, live from the NARSAL 2024 conference in Atlanta. And then response from party number two. I can respect that you don't want to be criticized, so I will be happy to refrain from doing that. From the strategic perspective, since the current situation is that October 1 is the time frame that the policy that requires an email, not the registrants, to be used, that will be subject to search and seizure to register. Yet if the fee is not paid, registration is prevented by the sheriff's office. The registrant is not allowed to use the internet, yet the sheriff requires that the registrant use the internet, or he cannot register. Whether or not, the sheriff's office can and has shown that he will arrest anyone who has not registered. If someone who is not allowed to use the internet uses the internet, they go to jail. If they don't use the internet, then they are, if they don't use the internet, then they are not registered and they go to jail. How exactly do you suggest that you de-escalate the situation? Either way, you're going to jail and there will be at least a year before you get to court. And then a second response from party number two, yep, someone, not me, should do something about this. Thanks so much for proving Christopher right yet once again. Nobody actually cares about fixing the problem. Good day.
Then I responded as follows. You're again on the attack, which is counterproductive. I do care or I wouldn't be consuming my personal time with you on Friday night. I'm not qualified to provide legal advice, so please stop the attack. This is not conducive to achieving your goals. The issue will be reviewed by NARSAL's paralegal as quickly as possible. In the meantime, I will not continue with you on this thread if you are rude one more time. Based on the timeline, I'd urge you or Christopher, that's the guardian, to contact an attorney who is licensed to practice in Missouri.
Another response from party number two. Well, I guess that I owe you an apology, as I understood you to be the attorney of record for NARSAL, and you were simply delegating to the paralegal to the work of research. I do appreciate that you're being responsive and willing to take my licks in my own behavior towards you. My friend is facing a serious situation and I'm trying desperately to get a national organization to help him with a very serious situation that he is facing. He has no money to pay for an attorney, nor has he had any luck with finding one that would be willing to help him in the first place because of the situation.
And I responded to that and I'm attempting again to de-escalate. I said, thank you for the kind words. Let's move forward from here, recognizing that I'm only a volunteer with NARSAL. We're in the process of trying to hire our first staff attorney. The funding we have available for the position is less than ideal for the massive responsibility the person will face. There's an infinite amount of cases that are worthwhile for litigation. The few that are chosen must be those cases that are likely to be successful and are properly developed with evidence. In addition, we try to exhaust all options prior to litigation due to the enormous expense as well as the number of years cases languish in courts. The goal at this moment is to develop a strong evidentiary record while simultaneously avoiding legal problems for the registrant that could potentially result in his arrest. His claims will be far more difficult to pursue if he's arrested and sitting in the county jail. attorneys charge even more money for visiting their clients in custody. And that was the end of it. So I give the guy, party number two, credit for the apology. He mistakenly thought that I was Narsil's attorney. I'm not licensed to practice law. I've been doing a lot of legal work for decades, but I don't hold a law license, and I'm not allowed to practice law. Everything I do for Narsil is in a volunteer capacity. And it's very stinging when you get these type of emails on a Friday night when you're trying to share your life with someone and be helpful, and they tell you what a loser you are.
Going back to the segment that we covered at the conference, I'm just wondering if there wasn't a little bit of theater going on. I don't remember what we said at the episode, but we could have been showing a little bit of theater that if you are not able to go to your representatives at the state capitol, if you have that permission, we're not talking about New Mexico where you're locked down in your county, but if you're able to go to the state capitol, I went to the state capitol while I was under supervision. Like Georgia, you can just roam from coast to coast if you want to in the state. But I'm just wondering if there wasn't a little bit of a exaggeration there on what your attitude should be if you're challenged for doing the things that you are constitutionally allowed to do.
There could have been. I would have likely said something to the effect that if I decided I was going to go to my capital to petition government for redress of my grievances, or if I were going to go to church, I would say I'm going to church. And that's precisely what I would do. But I don't recommend anybody do what I would do, because I'm better positioned than average person to deal with consequences. I'm better connected. I'm better funded. I have more knowledge about the law and how the system works, and I can fight back more effectively than the average person. But there's nothing would keep me from going to my capital if I wanted to go to the capital. But I pick my fights very carefully. I am very respectful to people I'm fighting with, my opponent, and that's what we do in this business. Chance and I talked privately on the phone, and it's just the way it works. The collegiality that we show our opponent is amazing. And people take that as being, you're selling them out. But it's the only way we can get things done. When we're working with the opposing party, nothing is gained by calling them names and telling them what losers and how disgusting they are. You just can't move a case forward and do your work that way. Chance, have you found it to be productive to tell the party on the other side of the state, of, well, since you're a defense attorney, you're mostly dealing with prosecutors. Have you found it productive to tell them what a piece of shit they are?
No, I found myself biting my tongue quite a bit, but it is counterproductive. Even though you may think that or feel that way, you still got to deal with this person. And ultimately, the person who loses over that argument is your client. So you've got to keep their objectives in your head and on your mind all the time.
And that's what I was trying to convey here. Let's keep the, I don't think there's a realistic chance of it being prosecuted, but if you fear that, you're there, I'm not. If you fear that, then you need to do what the sheriff said do for now so that you don't face that consequence. I think that if they would talk to a practitioner there, I think the practitioner of law would say that there's not going to be any prosecution from the Greene County Prosecuting Attorney's Office if the sheriff has required you to do this process to register. They're not going to turn around and prosecute. They're just not. But for some reason or another, that's the biggest fear, that he's going to have an email address and he's going to get locked up for having an email address.
And can I just ask for a couple of pieces of clarification? Like, his guardian person can't register on his behalf? I'm assuming that going to a webpage and typing in the person's name and typing in an address and taking a picture of him, whatever.
No,
his guardian person can't do that on his behalf?
It's not the registration. It's the scheduling that takes place electronically. You still have to go in person.
Oh, okay.
So,
but can't so he you, do you, that you, for him and get, hand him the yes. slip and say, here's your appointment?
Yeah, of course he could.
That's what I read in some of the emails. It was a voluminous amount of stuff, and I haven't had the opportunity to read all the stuff. But it appears as though that the sheriff's office said if you don't let him use the internet, just have someone else do it and make the appointment. But I think this is an overblown situation that can be de-escalated, and I'm all in favor of de-escalating things. We don't create problems that don't exist. And calling people ugly names and telling them they're a loser, this sheriff may be a loser. I'm not there. But the voters of Greene County don't think he's a loser. They anointed him with an enormous amount of power. Therefore, sheriff is the chief law enforcement in Greene County, and that's who you're going to have to take your cues from. For now.
All right, then. Can we move along to this little voicemail?
Indeed.
Very well. I titled this section, Leaving the State Temporarily. So to set it up, I guess, is there's an individual who is even in Discord now who has recently moved to a new state, and he recorded his conversation with the registration people, and they gave him some advice that I don't think is accurate. I'm not an attorney, but I don't know that I've never heard it told to me that if I left the state, even while on supervision, you have to abide by the laws of where you're going, of whether you register or not. There's nothing on the Georgia side that says that you have to, again, I was on supervision. I never had to tell the sheriff that I was leaving. I always had to get a travel permit, whatever. And I was in informing probation of my movement, but this individual is only on the registry, quote unquote, only. Did I set that up reasonably well, Larry?
You did indeed.
Okay. Well, I'm going to play this audio recording. I did modify the voices, hopefully to kind of protect people, but it's about a minute long.
Here's another thing. When you do go to New York, how long are you going to stay at a time? Like how many days?
Well, usually I stay, like when I came down here, it would be like a month. Mm-hmm. And then I'd leave. But New York, it probably wouldn't be that long. I just got to be up there.
If you go to New York and you stay longer than 14 days, then you have to re-register with them and you come off my registry. And then you'll come back here and I'll put you back on. So my advice will be don't stay longer than 14 days.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And when you do go up there, you have to text me and let me know the address that you're going to be at. And okay. You'll be there from this date to this date.
Okay.
Okay. We clear on that? You good?
Yeah.
All right.
Just for the first point, he's talking about going to New York. And if I'm not mistaken, New York is 10 days. If you're there longer than 10 days, then you have to register.
Okay. Well, I would say you've jumped ahead. It's not his job to enforce New York's law. His job's to enforce Georgia law.
Right. Sorry, I was speaking like just off my brain right there.
It may be 10 days. I'm not sure, but he would only be concerned as a sworn law enforcement officer carrying a certificate of a law enforcement certification in the state of Georgia. His job's not to enforce New York law. He can tell the registrant that you need to be familiar with New York law because they could come back to bite you in the butt, but his job is to enforce Georgia law.
And do you think that there's anything constitutional with, is this something of a travel restriction? Is it legal for the sheriff to impose restrictions on his movement like that, just as a quote unquote civil regulatory scheme?
There was nothing that voicemail suggested was any restriction on his movement. He can visit all he wants to. He just told him that he needs to re-register when he comes back. That's all he said. But I think that's incorrect.
I do too. I mean, I don't. Your residence remains your residence. You're not deregistering and leaving. You're just simply visiting. So I'm not sure I understand what the re-registering is. But I'd have to be more familiar with the rules of the state before I could say that correctly.
So. I did take a look at Georgia law, and I did not look at New York law. And nothing pops up in Georgia law that remotely suggests that that's a requirement. The closest thing, and the Georgia statute is in Dropbox, it's called combined, if you want to show it up on the screen, but I've highlighted paragraph 22 with yellow. And this is the closest thing I can come to what that deputy is saying. It says vocation means any full-time, part-time, or volunteer employment with or without compensation exceeding 14 days or for an aggregate period of time exceeding 30 days during the calendar year. Now, this is Georgia. They're wanting you to know that if you're going to be in Georgia for 14 consecutive days or for an aggregate, but he's twisted that, the sheriff's department or their county attorney has twisted that and tried to apply that to the other direction. But this is intended to cover people coming into Georgia. It has nothing to do, in my opinion, with anybody leaving Georgia. But that's where the only thing I can see in Georgia law that would resemble where that might be coming from.
Do you want to speak to his composure there in the office?
Well, the deputy seemed very professional and polite. I don't think the deputy invented this. I think this is what he was trained to do.
What about the PFR, though?
Oh,
the PFR, I'm kind of going against something that may have been accused of us of saying.
Well, I think his, from what I heard so far in the recording, he was very appropriate. I wish, I would not have made that phone call, but he did.
You wouldn't have made the recording?
I wouldn't have made the phone call.
He was in the office.
Oh, he was in the office. He wasn't doing that by phone.
Correct.
Well, if Georgia's a one-party state, he's the one party that knew about it, then he's got nothing to worry about from a legal perspective. But
that's at least what he told me. I'm pretty sure Georgia would be a one-party state.
But, yeah, I don't see that this is a legitimate thing. But the question would be, how do you want to handle it? Do you want to get nasty and say, you stupid F mother? Do you want to do that? Or do you want to say, hey, I was looking over the Georgia statute and I just am having trouble finding anything that resembles what you said. And I want to be in compliance. But what on earth? Where is that coming from? And of course, he's not going to know. He's going to say, well, that's what they trained me to do. Yeah, that's what he's going to say. But there's no need for hostility in this. He's not a stupid deputy. He's doing what he's trained to do. He's not a lawyer. He hasn't gone to law school. He has very minimal legal training.
And I'm not even trying to make this extend out, but do you go in there and I'm trying to be aggressively compliant. I'm trying to make sure that I stay well within the lines of this coloring book. Can you show me where it says this? Are you supposed to bring in a notice from an attorney and go, how do you then approach it from there? If they're going to demand that you do these things that you're not required to do.
Well, each person has a different, go ahead, Chance.
Yeah. I was just going to say, facially, it looks like what the guy with the deputy saying or whoever's talking to him, he seems to be implying that there's going to be an establishment of a new residence in another state, and if there is, he's acting as though you have to deprocess out of here first before you can do that, and I think you have to be clear about what you're doing. I think you just have to say, look, I'm living here. And I'm going to be there for a short time, but I'm not changing my residence. I'm just visiting, and slowly work your way from that juncture.
So,
Larry, do you remember way back, the first NARSAW conference in Atlanta, there was an individual that actually sent threatening letters. Do you remember that individual?
Yes.
He also... when his family lived in another state in the central South, and he would tell them down to the minute that he was leaving to the minute he was arriving at his destination and all that. And he was like, well, they told me to do it, so I'm complying. You don't have to do that, but that's what he would do. So he's not the only, this person in Augusta is not the only person, or South, this person's in the podunk part of Georgia. He's not the only one that's getting these kinds of rules put on them. Chance?
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking about this, and we're talking about it from a self-help point of view, but truth is, this is the kind of area where people call me for advice all the time. And, sometimes I get hired to call the police agency and kind of straighten them out so that they understand, what the law requires and what it does not. And, I have cordial conversations with them. I've had a few rough conversations, but generally, cordial enough to get them to look at it twice or to go on and to get to Jay to make it clear to them, especially this and in this context, that that's not required. So sometimes it takes a little bit more and you don't want to do it simply on your own. But, self-help wise, it's one thing, but, otherwise probably seek a professional's advice.
And
sounds very good.
I was going to say that I tend to play the Columbo, Detective Columbo part, if it's possible to act like you think you're right rather than being so arrogant. Now, when someone gets arrogant enough with me, I'm going to eventually say, I know I'm right. But I will, like when someone says unemployment was through the roof under Jimmy Carter, I'll say, well, actually it was not. And I can back that up with documentation. But there's no need for you to call people morons, idiots, and say ugly things to them. The deputy's doing what he's been instructed to do. And my style would be a deputy. I always want to be in compliance because I want to make your job as easy as possible. But I'm just not familiar with that provision. You know, I would like some help on finding it. Do you happen to know, you know, where in the state statutory scheme that is? And see what the deputy says. He's going to say he doesn't know. But that's the polite way to begin the dialogue. And then if he says, well, I don't know where it's at, say, well, would you do me a favor next time I come in here? Would you think you can find it and get, let's go over it? Because I'm just wanting to be compliant, but I'm not sure that that's correct. And let it go with that. And next time you go in and have the conversation again. You're going to get a lot further along with that approach than calling names and doing stuff. So for those people that are out there wanting to be the transcriptionist, this one is an example of why we can't use AI. If you read what AI said, because it wasn't typed, it says you stay longer than 14 days, then you have to re-rest. You're within many. Come off of my road street. I will guarantee you, I just listened to that video, that audio, and that is not what he said. But that's what was transcribed. Yeah. And that's what the type of corrections we have to do. You have to actually go back and listen to what was said, because every word is typed correctly here. Within many, come off my road street is exactly what was said. And re-rest is a word, but that were not the words that were spoken. So when the next person applies for the transcriptionist job, I need you to listen to the podcast while you're correcting it. Okay, that was a sidebar.
That was slightly a tangent.
So, yes, but it illustrates the point. You cannot rely on artificial intelligence to give you an accurate recitation of what we say.
All right, then. Are we moving along, then?
We are.
Moving along.
Here we go with a crucial update from the Second Appellate District in California. So let's dive in. The Second Appellate District recently published an opinion in People versus Mulberry, which seemed to be causing quite a stir. Can you give us an overview, Chance, of the case and its significance?
Absolutely. People v. Mulberry is a significant decision because it addresses the criteria for determining community safety and risk in the context of sex offender registration. The court affirmed the Superior Court's order denying a petition for a registrant convicted of violating Penal Code 288A, which involves lewd acts with a minor under 14 years of age. The petitioner, Harry Mulberry, had not reoffended since his conviction in 1991, but the court emphasized the severity and the frequency of the underlying conduct, which happened so long ago.
Well, that's very interesting. How does this decision differ from the Second Appellate's early opinion in People versus Franco that we talked about?
Well, the key difference lies in the interpretation of what factors are relevant to community safety, to a community safety determination. So in People v. Franco, the court rejected the relevance of what the petitioner could have been convicted of, but was not. However, in People v. Mulberry, the court took a different stance, considering the potential conviction for continuous sexual abuse as relevant to the risk assessment. This disagreement highlights a significant divergence in judicial interpretation within the same appellate district.
It does indeed. It even sounds like this could have broader implications for petition for removal in California. Have you thought about that?
Well, indeed, I have, and it could. The Mulberry decision suggests that courts may place more weight on the severity and frequency of the underlying conduct, as well as the character of the plea, even if the petitioner is not reoffended for many years, even like in this case, like almost 30. This could make it more challenging for individuals to be removed from the sex offender registry, as the court may consider hypothetical convictions and the petitioner's perceived lack of contrition or commitment to change.
Really? Could a petitioner's plea of no contest actually be equated with a lack of contrition?
Well, according to Mulberry, yes, it could. Yeah, the court of Mulberry equated the petitioner's no contest plea with a failure to admit error and a lack of contrition and commitment to change. This interpretation can influence how courts view similar pleas in future cases, potentially making it harder for petitioners to argue for removal from the registry based on their post-conviction behavior.
Well, but what about the burden of proof? We've made it clear from the, what was the name of that case, but the burden of proof rests with the prosecution. What was there any discussion of that in the Mulberry decision?
Well, interestingly, the burden of proof in detail. This omission could lead to further legal debates and challenges, as the burden of proof, which has been established in the Tye case, is a critical aspect of these proceedings.
Yeah, if I didn't have old timers, I could remember the Tye case. This certainly seems like a decision that could unsettle the petitioning process in California. What should legal practitioners and petitioners take away from this?
Okay, this is where the rubber meets the road. Legal practitioners should be aware of the potential for increased scrutiny on the severity and frequency of the underlying conduct, as well as the implications of a no contest plea. Petitioners should be prepared for a more challenging process and may need to provide substantial evidence of rehabilitation and low risk to the community safety.
Well, it's still disturbing that it seems to be upsetting Tye. Was Tye a Supreme Court decision? I think it was, wasn't it?
No, it was an appellate decision, and it seems to be pushing that way. This is a problem. It's not a burden of proof problem, but there are several factors that are considered in the process, and this is a facts and circumstances problem that can pretty much derail any progress made in Tye. Because before, you know, even if you have even if they have the burden of proof, they still can put forth these factors, and if you don't have anything to rebut those factors, you can get a pretty compelling no. I've done cases where facts and circumstances certainly, could have come into play. And I've had prosecutors say, hey, they should have been convicted of, but for the Tye case followed by the Franco case, it made it very clear you couldn't do that. Now we've got a case that kind of is the fly in the ointment.
Well, this is certainly a fascinating discussion on a very pivotal legal update regarding PFR relief in California. Stay tuned for the latest in legal expert commentary in our next California Corner.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Larry, this is from Phoenix from arizonasfamily.com. It says the court ruling this week banned agencies from posting mugshots online in Arizona. The justices say it's to protect individuals who have not been convicted of a crime, preventing a lifetime of embarrassment and shame. Isn't this a positive step?
It is, and it came from the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, the liberal bunch of lefties based in San Francisco. But yes, until the Arizona legislature overturns the ruling with a new statute, it is good news. And Maricopa County officials have claimed that releasing mugshots was best for transparency and public safety.
So would they do that, though?
Oh, absolutely. The legislatures overturn court decisions all the time. So absolutely they would do that. Whether it'll stand, but if they determine, the power structure in Arizona has determined that these mugshots are going to be released, they'll pass a new law in the legislature. It'll make its way to the governor. She'll likely sign it because she'll be painted as a softy on crime and one who denies the public's right to know, and it'll be signed. It'll have to be a challenge, a brand new challenge. So they would do that. That's what they'll scare the hell out of voters, who in turn will demand that the renegade court be constrained in the interest of public safety. That's exactly what's likely to happen.
Lawyers from Arizona's Family interviewed say having a mugshot online could lead to job losses, humiliation, and other harmful consequences for those not yet convicted. This is very embarrassing, right? You are taking one photo of someone most likely at one end at one of the worst days of their life, and you are blasting it all over the internet to mock them, said Jared Keenan, legal director for the ACLU, who is not affiliated with the case, in reaction to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision.
Yes, and defense attorney responded, named Jason Lamb. He stated, "They're always competing interests in a case like this. The public does have a right to know certain information, but that has to be balanced against the individual's right to privacy," Lamb stressed. that the ruling upholds the constitutional rights of those arrested, explaining that arrest is not the same as a conviction. He went on to say, they've merely been arrested, and there's not enough proof or even close to conviction.
Maricopa County currently posts mugshots of all recent arrests dating back 3 days, but third-party websites often take screenshots and repost these mugshots to their thousands of followers on social media, leaving individuals' names, faces, and charges online, even if their cases are dropped. What is your take on that?
It sucks. As the article points out, you only need probable cause to make an arrest, and that's a very small amount of evidence. Lots of people get arrested who later have their charges dismissed because there is not enough evidence that they actually committed a crime or that they're entirely innocent.
Arizona's family contacted the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office for a statement on the ruling, but was told that the office cannot comment on pending litigation. If appealed, the case could go to the Supreme Court. Do you think that the Supreme Court would take it? I got to think that they would.
I would not be surprised if they filed the cert petition, and I would not be surprised if it were to be granted.
Because that seems to be, that would be kind of a hot button that needs to be resolved, I would think. The article states that in 2024, California law, AB 1475, banned agencies from posting mugshots on social media. A bunch of liberal pointy heads out there for sure. Chance, you included, right?
Well, that's right. Yeah. As a matter of fact, on July 23rd, 5 was signed into law, and it was authorized by Assemblyman Evan Lowe. He's a Democrat, pointy head Democrat from Campbell, and who had noticed that an alarming trend of police and sheriff's departments posting mugshots online in order to shame suspects with no real public safety purpose behind the postings. The purpose of AB 1475 is to limit punitive harms to individual reputations and social perceptions due to law enforcement posting booking photos to social media, and also to provide a mechanism for nonviolent arrestees to initiate the removal of those photos from social media, believe it or not. AB 1475 forbids any police departments or sheriff's offices in the state of California from posting booking photos of suspects of nonviolent crimes on social media platforms, unless a limited circumstance applies, such as when the subject is considered a fugitive or possesses an imminent threat.
So, all right.
Haven't we figured out that the internet, like, never forgets?
It doesn't.
And if that stuff gets posted, even like the television mugshot, what's the perp walk, is incredibly harmful for people.
It is. Yeah. It is indeed. Only in the United States. Well, I shouldn't say only, but the United States is the big deviant from the rest of the civilized world on this.
Absolutely.
I'm pretty sure that we've run way over time, and we're gonna hightail it out of here.
We have indeed.
Chance, any parting words?
Thank you. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week.
Very quickly, head over and do likes and subscribes and follows and whatever you've got to do in your podcast app. Press like on YouTube if that's where you're watching it. This is released everywhere on every streaming platform and a podcast app that's out there. But head over to registrymatters.co for show notes and leave voicemail like Chris did at 747-227-4477. I take that back. He emailed it in. Email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And please, if you'd be so very kind, for as little as $1 a month, patreon.com/registrymatters to show some love for the program. Larry, I hope you have a fantastic weekend, and watch out for anything that crawls and bites.
Indeed. Good night.
Chance, enjoy your great weather, and I hope you have a fantastic weekend.
Much appreciated. Thank you. You too.
You've been listening to FYP.